Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back from our winter break. Good to have you all back. Braving the cold weather, sub-frigid temperatures, to be here to live together. Very honored to have Rabbi Meir Neuberger, Rosh Yeshiva of Or Yisrael, be speaking about the Smicha controversy, which he'll be talking about. Next week, Rabbi Osher Yavlach of Yeshiva Lento will be discussing the rationalists and the Kabbalists. Then we'll have another week off after that for Martin Luther King. I knew there was a weekend coming up. No other particular announcements. Without any further ado, Rabbi Neuberger.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Freundlich. I really appreciate being asked to research this subject because my experience with these classes is that I think I benefit the most because I was able to look into a subject that I hadn't looked into before. I'd heard about it before, but was able to read about it, and it opened a window into a really fascinating era of our history. So tonight's subject, let me just I just want to say what the subject is, the outline, and then we'll trace it back. Tonight's subject is the controversy about the attempt to renew the smicha, the ordination, the original from Mosaic ordination, to renew it, that attempt to renew it in Tzfat, that came out of the city of Tzfat, in the 16th century. And it was a debate. I wouldn't say it was as big a controversy as some of the other controversies that you've been studying, which had, you know, real ramifications and were very, very divisive. This wasn't such a divisive debate, but it was still very informative and really sheds a lot of light on the era. In short, I'll just tell you what the debate was, and then we'll go back and trace the concept. In the year 1538, in Israel at that time, the primary community was the community of Tzfat. It seems that there was a thriving textile business and industry, and then there were about 700 families living in Tzfat at that time, as opposed to Jerusalem, which was much more sparsely populated. The population in 1538 in Israel had a large population of Sephardic Jews who had fled Spain. If you realize this is 1538, the Inquisition started in Spain in 1492, right? And so there were some Jews who stayed, and under the guise of being conversos, of acting like they were Christians, and many, many fled. And a large group ended up in Israel, and there was a group of them who were in the city of Tzfat. The city of Tzfat had an amazing, it grew later, but had an amazing population of scholars there. And one of the biggest scholars was a man named Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, and he had the idea, and we'll talk a little bit more later about why he wanted to do it, of reinstituting the smicha. The smicha is the ordination. And I'm going to talk about it in a second, what that is. So he wanted to reinstitute the smicha, and we'll talk about why he wanted to do that also. And he was countered by the rabbi in Jerusalem, whose name was Rav Levi ibn Chaviv, Ralbach, son of Rabbi Yaakov ibn Chaviv, who wrote the Ein Yaakov. You might be familiar with Ein Yaakov on Gemara. So, and that was the debate. That was the discussion. Tonight, I would like to focus on what smicha is. What is it? What is this ordination? Why is it important? What happened to it that it had to be renewed? Why this Rabbi Yaakov Beirav wanted to renew it, what was motivating him, some of the technical issues about the basis of his argument to renew it, and what was the argument against. And then, after we get that history, to look at a little bit and see the backdrop of this, and see whether this represents a different type of tension, the tension of a messianically driven mandate where they're trying to do things to help bring redemption versus following the strict halachic strictures and having that determine your approach. Okay, so that's the plan for tonight. We're familiar with the concept of smicha. You know, when you get a rabbi, you ask, does he have smicha? Is he ordained? And the smicha that we're going to discuss tonight is different than the smicha which is practiced today. The smicha that's practiced today is really just a statement that someone studied a certain amount of material and is in a position to act as a rabbi to decide. It's not actually legally, halachically necessary, the smicha that we have today. It's really a formal thing. It's a way to have some type of quality control. It's something that developed actually in the Middle Ages, and the Sephardic community didn't accept the concept. They actually thought that it came from the academic world and it was borrowed from the Goyim, and until later they started doing it themselves. That's the present day smicha, which is really just a practical convention to allow people to have some type of standard. The real smicha, the original smicha, finds its root all the way in the Torah. Where do we have smicha in the Torah? Right, smicha. Where? Right, smicha of Yoshua. Oh, there you go. Moshe, smicha of Yoshua, and the 70 elders. Those are the two places where we find smicha in the Torah itself. Now, what does the word smicha mean? Smicha means leaning on or supporting oneself with. So there's smicha. Do you know there's another place in the Torah where we have smicha? In another area, not with regards to transferring rabbinic power, but by kavanos, right? A sacrifice that was offered, so the person who would bring the sacrifice would lean with all their weight on the animal that's being offered as a sacrifice. That's smicha. What do you think he's doing there? He's trying to say that I'm offering the sacrifice as a replacement for me, so to speak. Or he's like giving it status. A status as a carbon, as a sacrifice for him. Smicha that we find in the Torah, which relates from person to person, so it says it explicitly by Moshe and Yoshua. That's the first citation on page 1. Talks about Moshe was concerned. Hashem had informed him that he was not going to live to go into Eretz Yisrael, so he's worried who's going to take over leadership for the Jewish people. And he said to Hashem, Hashem, please find a person, appoint a person on the congregation who will lead them, go out in front of them, so that the people shouldn't be like sheep that have no shepherd. And Hashem said to Moshe, he said as follows. It's very interesting, the directions that Hashem gave Moshe. And what sees there, that's citation number one, the smicha of Yoshua from the Pasuk in Bamidbar. So Hashem said to Moshe, take Yoshua ben Nun, a person who has the spirit is in him, and samachta es yadcha aleihem, place your hands, lean your hands on him. Now yadcha happens to be singular or plural, yadcha. Your hand, right. And then Hamata Osoluf Ne Aaron HaKohen, stand him up in front of Aaron HaKohen. I mean, there's an official Eliezer HaKohen. So this official act of smicha takes place in the presence of the priesthood. Lufne Kol Ha'eda, in front of the whole congregation. B'tzivisa also at Leinehem, and in front of all of them, you are going to give him his mission. Tzivisa, you're going to command him. How they translate, and give him a charge in their sight. And it says, "Nasata mehotcha alav," and you will give from your glory, from your specialness unto him, so that they should all, the congregation, will listen to him. In front of Elazar the priest, he'll stand and he'll be able to use the tool of the Urim v'Tumim, the special mechanism in the Choshen, which allowed a certain level of prophecy to find out what to do. And Moshe did, like Hashem said, he took Yoshua and he stood him in front of Elazar HaKohen, and he bayismoch es yadav, and he put his hands, yadav with the yud means, how many hands? two, right? He did both of his hands. Vayisaveho, and he gave him a charge like Hashem spoke to him. So what's going on in this parsha? What's happening? What's being dealt with? A transfer of leadership and spirit, and giving him the ruach, the spirit that he has from Moshe. Moshe's spirit he's transferring to Yehoshua, and this gave Yehoshua authority. Another place where we have this was with the 70 elders. Earlier in Bamidbar, Moshe complained, and he said, "I can't maintain the entire burden of the whole Jewish people all by myself. I can't do it." And he said that I need help, Hashem. He says it's too heavy for me. So he told Hashem. Hashem says to Moshe, "Okay, I'm going to get you some help. Gather 70 people from the elders of Israel that you know that they are the elders of Israel and their leaders." And take them to the Ol Moed and stand them there with you. And Hashem says, I will then come down, Dibarti Imach, I will speak to you there. Interesting. Hashem says, I'm going to speak to you, Moshe, in front of these 70 elders, Ba'asalti min haruach, and I'll transfer from the spirit that's on you, and I will give it on them. And then they will be able to take the load from you, and you will not have to carry by yourself. So that's what happens. Pasuk Chavdalim, this is the second citation there. Moshe went out, spoke to the people the words of Hashem, gathered the 70 people, stood them up. Hashem came down and spoke to Moshe and transferred and took the spirit that was upon him and put it on the 70 elders. And then what happened? What was the result? As soon as they got the spirit, they started prophesizing and acting as prophets. So this is a second example of smicha. It doesn't mention here, what it doesn't mention anything about what? About Moshe laying his hands, right? And it talks about a transfer of the spirit that's on Moshe to the 70 elders. The Rashi there brings the metaphor of a candle that lights other candles and gives of its light, but doesn't, its own light is not diminished. And this is cited also in the Gemara, we'll see in a second, as an example of smicha. Interesting thing is, why is it that Hashem had to come down and speak to Moshe in their presence? What do you think that's about? You know, it says, I understand the transfer of Moshe's spirit, but why is Hashem, it says explicitly, Hashem spoke to Moshe and then transferred. You get the sense that the result of this was that they started prophesizing. So Moshe had to be put, so to speak, in the prophecy mode. Hashem is speaking to Moshe in their presence. And in that context, Moshe's gift and powers were somehow exposed, and Hashem then transferred them, those powers, to the 70 elders, to the 70 Zakenim. So in this case, what's being transferred here? It's not leadership. It's more what? What's the role of the 70 elders to help Moshe with what? With judging, right? The power to litigate, the power to adjudicate. I mean, to decide and to provide leadership. And these are the two examples of smicha which the Gemara talks about. This smicha. You know, like the Mishnah in Avos talks about the chain of transmission. The Rambam, in his introduction to Mishnah Torah, also talks about the chain of smicha. And this chain of smicha from teacher to student, and then to the next generation, went on and on. And this is considered the true smicha. This is considered the true smicha. This continued until about 300 years after the destruction of the temple, 370 or 400, not exactly clear, when the Romans finally decided that they couldn't have allow the Sanhedrin and the Nasi to exist, the leaders of the Jewish people, and at that point the smicha stopped. And that was the end of smicha. Now, that is what smicha is. What is smicha relevant for? What do you need it for? What's its function? So, but before we go further, what can we say from these two sources? What is smicha? What are the two biblical sources for smicha? Transferring leadership from Moshe to Yoshua, and transferring the power or the abilities of Moshe Rabbeinu to a group of people to allow them to help him in the judging of the people. The result was prophecy. That's what they got. They got this ruach, this spirit from Hashem, that was going from Hashem to Moshe and then from Moshe to them. And the result is that they got a prophetic ability. Okay, so that's the history a little bit. But what's the relevance of smicha? What is the function of smicha, and why is it necessary? So the Mishnah in Sanhedrin talks about the different courts. The Masechta Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is really a Greek word, which means an assembly, is the term for the different types of courts that they had in the Jewish people. There are three levels of Jewish courts. There's a court of three people, a court of 23, which each area had, and a court of 71, which met in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Lishkas HaGazis, in a special room. And that was called the Beis Din HaGadol, the Great Court. Each of these courts had different responsibilities. So, for example, only the Sanhedrin HaGadol, only the Great Beis Din HaGadol, the Sanhedrin, had the ability to coronate or make a king, or to establish or to make a declaration of war. There were certain things, if there was an Iran Idachas, there were certain things, a city that as a group, worshipped the Bodhisar that has a specific punishment. Only they were able to do that. Lower courts had the capacity to do, also Mises Bezdin, to punish people, capital punishment, didn't need the 70 court of 71, but did need the court of 23. And that's also true for corporal punishment, to give lashes, that required only a court of three. If there are issues of loans or damages, lower courts could handle that. But there's one thing that all these courts had in common, and that in order to be a member of these courts, you had to have this smicha. You had to have been ordained by a person who was ordained, who could follow the chain all the way up to Moshe Rabbeinu. An unbroken chain of smicha was necessary in order to be a dayan, to serve on any of these courts. All these courts required smuchim. The source for that is the use of the language Elohim. And the Torah, it says, Ad Elohim Yavod Dvar Shneim, and the fact that the court is called Elohim, which is a word that speaks about power and authority, we learn from there that they have to be a mumcha, they have to be an expert, and they have to have smicha that traces all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? Now, it happens to be that there were some mechanisms that they used. So, for example, there was a concept of agency that they said in places where the smicha was not available, they had a concept of agency which they used for loans and damages and things that happened frequently where they needed to have some type of court system. So they allowed those places to act as agents, as shluchim of the ordained courts. But that did not apply to things like capital punishment or corporal punishment or even knossos. Knossos means fines. So the ability to say that even if you don't owe money and you didn't borrow money and you didn't really damage anyone, but the court is going to impose a fine upon a person, for that they said there was no concept of agency, and that can only be done if you actually have the smicha. Okay, so let's take a look for a second at citation number, let's go page number 2 first. Page number 2. Okay. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, just to read this Gemara, because this Gemara is a source for a lot of what we know about Smicha, and it also has this famous story that's actually relevant to the discussion. So you would see that citation number 3, Talmud Bavli, Gemara Sanhedrin 13b. So it says over there that one of the things, so you need Smicha, okay, so let's review again, you need Smicha in order to serve on a court. And whether it's a court of 3 or a court of 23 or a court of 71. What about the transmission of the smicha? So the Gemara says that the transmission of the smicha also requires a court of 3. So the Mishnah in Sanhedrin says a list of different things, of different processes that require a court of 3, and one of them is the transmission of the smicha. So you couldn't just have one person who had smicha then giving smicha to other people. They had to do it in the context of a court. It was considered a maisa bezdin, an act of a court to ordain another person. So it's taught that the laying of the hands of elders, meaning the smicha that's done to ordain, has to be done with 3. So Gemara says, where did you get this concept of 3? If you use Moshe as the source, if you use Moshe as the source of it, so then you should be enough with just one. And if you tell me that Moshe is somehow equal to stood in the place of 71, why do you think Moshe would stand in the place of 71? Because somehow his ruach went over to 70 people, so he's like 71, so then you should require a court of 71. So Mara says it doesn't really have a good answer for this. This difficulty doesn't get resolved. And the idea that I saw explained is that the truth is that the transmission of ordination really comes from one person. But it has to be done in the context of an authoritative group. So he has to be part of a court, but the real smicha is coming from him, but it has to be done by a court. In other words, the power of the smicha, the chain, is created through the person who has the smicha. But the authority to actually transmit the smicha from him to the person is done in the context of a court. Okay. Then the Gemara says that the literal laying of the hands is not something that's done anymore. Some say because it's interesting why that got stopped. And it said it's the conferring of the degree. It's saying that the person is now called Rabbi. This is why you find some of the Tanaim who populate the Mishnah and the Amoraim were called Rabbi because they received smicha. Those who did not receive the smicha were not called Rabbi, but they were just called Rav. What determined whether people received the smicha or had in the time of the Gemara? What determined whether they received the smicha or not? That was dependent on something we're going to see in a moment, that smicha can only be transmitted in Eretz Yisrael. An interesting concept. Smicha can only be given over in Eretz Yisrael. If the person who's giving the ordination is not in Eretz Yisrael, or the person receiving the ordination is not in Eretz Yisrael, their smicha is not valid. So what you find is that all the rabbis and scholars in Bavel who populate the Talmud Bavli are all not referred to as Rabbi, they're all referred to as Rav. But the Tanaim of the Mishnah, which was written in Eretz Yisrael, and Amoraim of the Talmud Yerushalmi, are all referred to as Rabbi, because the transmission of Smicha needs to be done only in Eretz Yisrael. It's an interesting concept. It begs the question. What's the question that it begs? This statement that the transmission of smicha has to be done in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah?
The first smicha was not done
yet. Exactly, right. The first smicha was not done in Eretz Yisrael. That's true. That's very true. So why would there be this concept that the transfer of smicha has to be in Eretz Yisrael? Does anyone know something else that also we say only happens in Eretz Yisrael? Nevuah, right. Prophecy is something that only happens in Eretz Yisrael. Where did we see a connection between smicha and nevuah? There's a Canaan. As soon as they got their smicha, they prophesied. But then there you have the same question. Moshe had his prophecy in the Midbar. So it seems that there's a difference between the Jewish people before they came to Eretz Yisrael and after they came to Eretz Yisrael. After they entered Eretz Yisrael, the Yanika, the place where they got their spiritual connection, was limited to Eretz Yisrael, to the Makam HaMikdash. So that was the place of connection. And a prophet from that point on can only get their prophecy in Eretz Yisrael. And smicha, the ability to transmit this rabbinic authority, can only happen in Eretz Yisrael. Which really gives you a clue that you're not dealing here with just a decision that we need a system to create standards and authority and a body that will qualify who can decide and adjudicate, because we're dealing with something spiritual here. And the same way that Moshe needed Hashem to come to speak to him in order for him to be able to give over of his spirit to the people, to the 70 elders, so you need to be in the proximity of Eretz Yisrael in order to give over of his spiritual power to the next person who he's giving smicha to. Yeah. Yeah, excellent question. So Gemara says that even if he had smicha in Eretz Yisrael, even though it's limited to receiving smicha in Eretz Yisrael, he could, however, rule outside of Eretz Yisrael. Yes. Very good. So Gemara says a question. You're telling me that the transmission of smicha is only done with three people. Gemara asks a question from the following story. The Romans, the Romans in the first century, in the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, they were struggling with the Jews. The Jews were asserting themselves, and the Romans were trying to put them down. And they, I think it was Augustus. He said that no smicha is allowed. They came to the conclusion that the ability of the Jewish people to maintain themselves as an entity depends very much on their ability to have the system of their courts and the ability to teach and the authority that smicha gives them. And if they could eliminate the smicha, if they could break the chain, then whatever the drive, the engine, the connection that the Jewish people have to Moshe Rabbeinu that they need in order to provide the appropriate leadership for their people would be broken, and it would be a lot easier to deal with them. That's what they decide. That's what they determined. Therefore, they made smicha prohibited. And the Gemara says as follows, that there was a Tana named Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, does anyone recognize that name from the liturgy at all? Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, on Yom Kippur, when we say the Asar Haruge Malchus, the ten martyrs, he's one of them, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. And the story of his martyrdom is as follows. So Gemara says, Rabbi Yehuda says the name of Rav, that this person should be remembered Latov, Zachur Latov. His name is Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. It says, if it weren't for him, the laws of Knas would have been forgotten in Israel. Meaning all the ability to adjudicate and to give fines, which is like the sign, the stamp of having smicha, would have been forgotten. I said, why would they be forgotten? They could have been learned. So it says, it means that the laws would have never been able to be carried out. Because once the wicked government, that's the word for the Roman government, decreed that whoever performed an ordination should be put to death. And whoever received ordination should be put to death. And not only that, the city that the ordination took place should be demolished. And the boundaries within that the ordination had been performed should be uprooted. So they were really bent on it was Hadrian, that was it. Hadrian was really bent on making sure that smicha wasn't done. He actually threatened the entire community in which a smicha was done. What did Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava do? He went out into the wilderness between two mountains that lay between two large cities, out of the Tchum Shabbos of Usha and Shepharim, and there he ordained five elders. Rabbi Yehuda, that's Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir is one of the basic Tanaim. Rabbi Yehuda is Rabbi Yehuda bar Eloi. Rabbi Shimon is Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, right, who's associated with the Zohar. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Elazar ben Shammua. These five people who were students of Rabbi Akiva, as he was too, he passed on smicha to them. And he was the last person in the chain of smicha, and he passed it on to them. And smicha was able to survive for another 150 years. So as soon as the enemies discovered them, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava urged them, "My children, flee." They said, "What will become of you, Rabbi?" He says, "I lie before them like a stone, which none is able to overturn." And it says that the Romans speared him with 300 iron spearheads into his body. 300 a lot of times in the Gemara is the language of extreme. That's 300, but obviously a lot. They mutilated him, and that was the story of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava's martyrdom. That he became a martyr because in the process of transferring smicha. So the Gemara asks, if Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava did smicha, how many people was he? He was only one person. So you see that you can do smicha without the benefit of a court. And the Gemara says that Yehuda ben Bava had other people with him, but in his because of his honor, those other people were not mentioned. And then the Gemara says, Yehuda ben Levi says, there's no ordination outside of Palestine, outside of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so what do we learn from this Gemara? That ordination has to be passed on, has to be transferred from person to person, in order to be able to function as a judge. Yehuda ben Bava sacrificed his life in order to provide a link in the process of ordination. And we also learned that ordination can only be done in Eretz Yisrael. What happened when ordination was... So another 200 years passed, and then ordination was actually squelched. It was actually stopped. The leadership of the Jewish people was led by the house of the Nasi, Hillel's family, Hillel HaZaken. And there were 14 generations until the last Hillel. And that represents the end of the period in which there was Jewish leadership in Eretz Yisrael, and also represents the end of ordination. Now, something happened at that time because as a result of that. Do you know, if you're familiar, that the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar, correct? In other words, we count time and count years based on the months of the moon. How do you determine when a new month comes? So it says, Hashem told Moshe and Aaron, HaChodesh Hazel Lachem, this month, this is a new month, last week we learned it. And we learn from there that people like Moshe and Aaron, who are smuchim, are the people who are in charge of establishing a new month. How do they do it? Witnesses come and say that we've seen that the moon has gone to a position where now it's visible, and that represent they come and testify to the court. The court makes a proclamation, Mekudash, Mekudash, the new month is sanctified, and a new month is created. This is very significant for Jewish life, because the new month determines when the dates of the month will be. And in order to know when to celebrate the holidays, and when to not eat chametz, and when to fast on Yom Kippur, and when to live in a sukkah, you need to know when the new month starts. So the calendar really is the domain of the courts. And you need smuchim in order to make a new month. As machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban, whether you need a court of 23 or a court of 3, but everybody agrees in order to establish the calendar, in order to establish that the Rosh Chodesh Adar is on this and this day, because witnesses came, you need a court, and that court has to be made of dayanim who have smicha. So what happens when there is no more smicha? How do we have a calendar? So The rabbis were always aware of the calculations that are involved in how long it takes the moon to go around Earth. And how many months you need to have in order to make the lunar year equal to the solar year over a certain number of years. So what Hillel, the last Hillel, he's called Hillel Hasheni, what he did is he made the calculations for a cycle of a calendar that can go on infinitely. And he used his power as a samuch, his power as a person who had smicha, to ordain and establish the new months in the future. So the way the Rishonim say it is, you know, when we have Kiddush HaChodesh, Brichas HaChodesh, right? And we say, Rosh Chodesh Adar, Yiyah B'Yom, Shashlishi Haba Aleinu L'Kol Yisrael Tova, when we say that Rosh Chodesh is going to be on Tuesday, we are, in a way, channeling Hillel Hasheni's statement. He already said, by establishing the calendar in the 3rd century, that's when Rosh Chodesh Adar is going to be. And we're just acknowledging that that's when it is. In other words, the authority of the court to establish this year that we're in Tafshin Ayin Dalet, the authority of the court, where's the authority of the court to establish the new month? It's the authority of that court. In the 3rd century, the last court of Smuchim, Hillel Hasheni, he established a calendar. And he said, the calendar is a system, it's a 19-year calendar, and it's a 35-year calendar. It has a system that he established, and it's his authority that makes the calendar work. So you have Smuchim actually establishing the new year. It's an interesting thing. You ever notice what happens? The Chazan says that Rosh Chodesh is going to be on this and this day. And then everyone else says Rosh Chodesh is going to be on this and this day. Were you ever struck by that? It's a little strange, no? You think, if it's an announcement, who should make the announcement? Okay, the Chazan makes the announcement. But what's everyone else saying afterwards? Right? The Chazan says Rosh Chodesh Adar Yeh B'Yom HaShlishi Abba Alei B'Chol Yisrael Tova. And everyone else says Rosh Chodesh Adar Yeh B'Yom HaShlishi. What's that about? So it seems like almost as if that we want to have the collective Jewish people, the mass of the Jewish people, who we're trying to get our authority here to establish this new month, and we channel the authority, so to speak. We're using the authority of that Hillel who established the calendar, but we're validating it with what we're doing. And we'll see that might be relevant, this idea of the mass of the people having the power to somehow express what then convey the power that smicha gives. So that's what happened after the year. It was about, I see different dates. Some people say the date 425, I saw 380, but that was the time that smicha ended. So from that time on, it's pretty much at the end of the Gemara also. From that time on, there's no more capital punishment. The truth is, capital punishment had stopped earlier. 40 years before the destruction, Sanhedrin said, we're not doing the capital punishment. But there wasn't corporal punishment, and there weren't fines, and a lot of the capacities of Sanhedrin, of Bezdin, were limited. Yeah?
How did they do these calculations that they're all still so accurate?
There are some flaws because they use the similar to the Julian calendar. In other words, and that's why the Tei Talmud, there are certain things that, but they figured out, they had that broken down when they say how many halakim, they broke down the hour into 1,080 parts, and they had a pretty good judgment of what they wanted to do. They figured out how many lunar months and how many years will equal how many solar months. So, and how do you make sure that it stays even the 19-year cycle? And they established it. They established that authority. Okay. So now, that's how things are. That's how things were going until, fast forward, to the year 1538. In the year 1538, like we had said, that 1538 was very soon after the Spanish Inquisition. Now, the Spanish Inquisition was a tremendous tragedy for the Jewish people. You know, things were not doing well for the Jews in Germany either. And in Spain, they had been thriving. They had been functioning well in society. They themselves, Jewish learning had thrived, and they were told to leave. Many of them went first to Portugal, and then they had to leave from there. The ones who stayed had to go underground and act as conversos, as Muranos. And we'll see that. There even were great rabbis, and this comes up in the discussion. Reb Levi Ibn Chaviv was a teenager, and he had to, in Portugal, and he had to assume a Christian name and act like he was a Christian. And in the debate, in some of the heated points in the debate, that was actually brought up, that skeleton was brought up, and he talked about it honestly. It was a tremendous tragedy for the Jewish people. They were forced to go to different places. They went to the Mediterranean basin. For example, this Rav Yaakov Beirav was a child in 1492. He then had to go to Algeria, Morocco. He was in Fez. He was became a rabbi there. Then he went to Egypt. A lot of people were living in Cairo at that time. And ultimately, he made his way to Tzfat, which was the center of the Jewish community in Israel. There was at this time there was a lot of Kabbalistic movement also. So for example, there was a famous. Have you ever heard of Shlomo Molcho, Solomon Molcho? Anyone heard of him? Solomon Molcho was a Shlomo Molcho. He was a child of Muranos. He actually was brought up Christian, and he was had a job in Portugal in the royal environment over there. He became exposed to a person named Reuven Hadayani, a person who came with a really interesting story as a Jew, representing the Jews of Eastern Europe, and he got interested. He circumcised himself in his 20s. He escaped Spain, went to Turkey and studied under Rabbi Yitzchak Teitzak, Rabbi Yosef Teitzak, and must have been a brilliant man. He absorbed a tremendous amount of learning and he became a Kabbalist in a very short time. People were flocking to his lectures, and he became close there at that time with Rabbi Yosef Cairo. Rabbi Yosef Cairo is famous for being the author of the Shulchan Aruch, right? And Yosef Cairo ended up also in Tzfat, where he's buried. And this Shlomo Molcho ultimately did some amazing things. He predicted an earthquake in Portugal and a flood in Rome, and the Pope was interested in him. Ultimately, he was given over to the Inquisition and offered the option of reverting to Christianity. And he chose to remain a Jew, and he was martyred. He was burned at the stake. This of Shlomo Molcho became a messianic type figure. He actually predicted that Moshiach was going to come in the year 1540. He also spent some time in Tzfas also. So you have this community in Tzfas where you have a real concentration of scholarship. You have this Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, who was a great scholar. Rabbi Yosef Cairo was already in Tzfas at that time. You have a person named the Mabit, Moshe of Trani, who was a tremendous scholar. So in these 700 families, you have groups, a level of scholarship that's very, very amazing. A tremendous level of scholarship. And Rabbi Yaakov Beirav felt that the time was ripe to renew the smicha. Now, renew the smicha? How could you renew the smicha? The smicha is something that's a chain for Moshe Rabbeinu, right? You need to be a samoch in order to give smicha to someone else. You have to be an ordained person. The whole point is to keep this chain alive all the way back. Can you imagine that concept to be part of a chain that can trace itself all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu? But once it's gone, it's gone. But he wanted to renew the smicha. And he wanted to do it based on a statement of the Rambam. Now, before we get to the statement, why did he want to renew the smicha? What was motivating him to do this? So there's a lot of material. Because it was such debate, there was a lot that was published at the time, and you can really read it, and it's very fascinating. One of the reasons he gave why he wanted to renew the smicha was as follows. There are certain averos that a person violates for which the punishment is kares. Kares is excision. There are different types of kares, the Rambam says. There's kares that means the person will die young, and there's kares which sounds a lot scarier, which is the soul being cut off from connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is an eternal punishment. So says the Ribei Rav, says Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav, that there were many Jews who in Spain were forced to act as if they were Christians. They didn't want to leave, or they weren't able to leave, and they had to take up a life ostensibly of acting like a Christian. Some of them continued to do things in private, but a lot of them had to violate prohibitions for which the punishment is kares. When they were ultimately able to leave, they felt bad about this. They were concerned about the future of their neshama. They were concerned about the future of their lives. And there was a certain stigma attached to them. I saw that there was a tshuva, a responsa written by Rabbi Yosef Cairo, like 50 years after this time, to the city of Candia in Crete, where he was saying that the Muranos who had emigrated there were being mistreated, and he was saying how people have to treat them correctly and they can't be stigmatized. So there obviously was an issue. So says Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav that the Mishnah in Makos says that if a person undergoes lashes, which a lot of times was a punishment that was there in addition to the kares, then the stigma of kares is removed. After v'nikla achicha le'enecha, it says when it talks about lashes that your brother will be nikla, will be embarrassed because he gets the lashes. After he gets the lashes, he's called achicha, your brother. So if a person did an avera for which the punishment is kares, excision, and they're punished with lashes and malkos, the stigma of the kares goes away. They don't have the kares on them anymore. So says Yaakov Bei Rav, we want to be able to do this. We want to be able to give the punishment of malchus, of lashes, to people who want to free themselves of the stigma of kares, of spiritual excision. And in order to do that, but there's a problem. In order to do that, what do you need to have? A court that in order to give corporal punishment needs to have smuchim. All three need to be people who have smicha. But the smicha is gone. So what are we going to do? So says Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav is that there is a way out. And the way out is based on the Rambam. So if you turn to page 3, the Rambam and the Laws of Sanhedrin, chapter 4. I copied a lot of the laws there, but you know, a lot of the things we've talked about. And the Rambam says, if you can skip, if you take a look yourself, but if you skip to Halacha 11, what do you do? The Rambam talks about smicha being a chain, and the need to have a person who has smicha in order to create more people have smicha. So in Halacha 11 it says as follows. If there was only one judge in Eretz Yisrael who possessed smicha, let's say for some reason there was only one person left who possessed smicha, so what's he going to do? Now the Rambam's opinion is that even though you need a court to convey smicha, a court of three, not all the three people have to have the smicha. So there's one person who has the smicha, he's like the engine of the transferal, and then the other members of the court don't need to have smicha. So the Rambam says, if there's only one judge in Eretz Yisrael who possesses smicha, he should call two other judges to sit with him, And they should convey smicha on 70 judges at one time or one after another. Afterwards, that's how you get 70 people a smicha. Afterwards, he and these 70 should join together to make up the Supreme Sanhedrin and grant smicha to others to make up other courts. Okay? So this is the situation when you have only one person left who has smicha, how from that energy he can somehow create a court of 71. He'll convene another two people, and the three of them will give smicha to 70 other people, and then you'll have 71 people with smicha, which is the number that you need for the Beis Din Hagadol, for the great Beis Din. And then they'll be able to do everything that they need to do. How about if you have nobody? So this is what the Rambam says. This is the bolded part. Listen to what he says. It appears to me, now the Rambam doesn't say that so many times, venerally, it appears to me, that if all the wise men in Eretz Yisrael agree to appoint judges and convey smicha upon them, the smicha is binding. And these judges may adjudicate cases involving financial penalties, knas, and convey smicha upon others. The Rambam says an amazing thing. You can jump start the smicha. You can create that energy out of nothing, even though there's no chain. How? What does he say? What are the conditions? All the wise men, all the chachamim, in Eretz Yisrael. Now the in Eretz Yisrael part we get. All the chachamim in Eretz Yisrael decide to convey a smicha onto one person, they can make that person a samoch, and he has all the status of smicha. You hear this? An amazing thing. Where did he get this from, Rambam? Where did he get this concept that it's, first of all, where did he get the concept that it's possible to get smicha started? And where did he get the concept that the way to do it is to get all the rabbis in Israel to agree? Right? Right? Where did he get this from? So the truth is, I'll tell you where he got it from. Here he doesn't say his source. But the Rambam wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. You may remember from the class on the Rambam. It was called the Pirush of Mishnayos. He wrote it in Arabic. Actually, in Arabic. And he wrote it when he was younger. And there he writes the following thing. It's an assumption that he's talking about there about what's going to have to happen before Mashiach comes in order for Mashiach to be able to come. And he says, if you look back on the last citation on the other page, citation number 4, the Pasuk in Isaiah, Pasuk in Yeshayah, talks about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And Yeshayah talks about how what brought Hashem to destroy Yerushalayim was the breakdown in judgment. It was the fact that there were judges who were corrupt, and that they were atama ratzachim, now they're murderers, and that judgment, the breakdown of justice in society, was one of the reasons why Hashem destroyed Yerushalayim. And it says over here, so it says that if you see over there, Yeshaya cries, how has Echa Hayelazona Kiryan Emana Meleis Mishpat? Meleisi Mishpat was filled with justice. Tzedek Yalimba, righteousness was lodged in her. Va'atam Ratzchem, and now they're murderers. If you continue, you see they don't Yasam the Lo Yishpotu. They don't judge for the Yasam, the orphan. Riv Almana Lo Yavo Alam. The arguments, the deal of the Almana, of the widow, that would come to them. So Hashem says, Lochein Hashem Elokim. Hashem says, Hoy Anachem Yitzarav Yinachme Me'orvam. I'll take revenge against them. Vashiva Yadi Alayach, and I will place my hand. Vashrof Kabor Sigayach, and I'll purge away thy dross as with lye. Vashiras Vidilayach, and I'll get rid of your impurities. And that's referring to a time of punishment. And then what does it say? Vashiva Shoftayach Varishona. And then I'll bring back your judges as in the beginning. Yoasayach and your counselors, Kabatchila, as in the first. Acharei Kain, after that, Yikarei Lach, you'll be called Ir HaTzedek, the city of righteousness, Kiryat Nemana, at a faithful city. Sion b'mishpati padeh b'shaveh b'tzaka. Zion shall be redeemed with justice, and they will return to her with righteousness. So says the Rambam, that in order for Mashiach to come, you have to first establish justice. There has to be a restoration of the judges. And you know, we echo that in Shemona Esrei. The second six brachos of the middle 12 brachos in Shemona Esrei talk about the progression that's involved for Mashiach to come. So first you have Tzikah b'shofar gadol cheruseinu, there'll be an in-gathering of the exiles. And it ends up with what? B'Yerushalayim ircha, you come back to Yerushalayim, and then Estemach David, then the Scion of David will be brought, Mashiach. But what has to happen before that? What's the first thing that has to happen after Kibbutz Goliath? What's the bracha? Shiva Shofteinu Kivarishon of Yatzeinu Kivatchila, which is reflecting this pasuk. There has to be a restoration of justice in order for the Mashiach to come. So therefore there's a tradition that the Sanhedrin is going to have to be reestablished before Mashiach will come. Now the Sanhedrin can only function if there is smicha. How do you have a Sanhedrin without smicha? So says the Rambam in Pirush HaMishnayos, how is this going to happen at the end of time? It must be that smicha can be reestablished without the presence of a link in the chain of smicha all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So based on this assumption, A, that the Sanhedrin has to be reestablished before Mashiach can come, the Rambam says there must be a way to reestablish Sanhedrin and to have smicha that doesn't involve an unbroken chain. And the Rambam says, what is the way to do it? So he says, look back to the Rambam, Halacha 11, he says, so it seems to me that if all the wise men in Eretz Yisrael will agree to appoint judges and convey smicha upon them, that the smicha is binding. And then the judges have all the status, and then they can then transfer that smicha to other people and make a 71 smuchin. So then he asked a question on himself. We mentioned the Gemara before about Rabbi Yehuda Mabava. What did Rabbi Yehuda Mabava do in order to make sure that the chain of smicha was unbroken? He sacrificed his life. He served as a buffer for his students. He went out and he knew he was going to get killed. Why did he do that? Keep the smicha alive. Why do you have to keep the smicha alive if you can renew the smicha without a chain? Didn't Yehuda ben Bava also know this idea? So the Rambam says, he asked this question himself. He says, if so, why did the sages suffer anguish over the institution of smicha? Why do we say that Yehuda ben Bava sacrificed his life to keep financial penalties viable in Knossos? And his answer was, because the Jewish people were dispersed. At his time, at Yehuda ben Bava's time, they were dispersed. They weren't focused in one place, in Israel. And it's impossible that they could all agree. And therefore he felt, in order to keep smicha alive, plan B, which is to have renewal of smicha through all the rabbis saying, we agreed to give smicha to a certain person, was not an option. And therefore, he had to keep plan A, the unbroken chain of smicha, alive, and for that he sacrificed his life. If, by contrast, there was a person who received smicha from another person, which he kept alive, then you don't need to require of all of them. Instead, he can adjudicate involving financial penalties for everyone, because he has smicha from a court. Then the Rambam says the following words. He says, I'll tell you in Hebrew, he says, "V'hadavar tzarech hechreya." And the issue, the thing, however, needs resolution. Hechreya means it has to be decided. So that sounds pretty hedging, right? He starts off saying, it appears to me, and he ends off saying, I need hechreya, this is something that needs resolution. The Rambam does not write that anywhere else, I don't think, in the Aruch HaZaka, where he says such a type of statement. But this was definitely an idea that the Rambam had, and he had developed this earlier, and he expressed it in the Pirush HaMishnayos. And what was it motivated by? By really messianic thoughts. By the fact that he felt that in order for Mashiach to come, there has to be Sanhedrin. Because Sanhedrin has to be established in order for Mashiach to come. Because the whole destruction came because of the breakdown in justice. Justice has to be reestablished and then Mashiach can come. How is that going to happen unless they can jumpstart the smicha from nothing. How do you do that, says the Rambam, if all the Jews of Israel, all the Chachamim of Israel agree to give smicha, they can jumpstart the smicha. So, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav said, I'd like to do this. Let's do this. We have our chance right now. Because he said, look, what's going on in Israel at this time? There had been people in Akko, but that wasn't much anymore. Here you have an opportunity where you have a tremendous concentration of scholarship in the city of Tzfat. Now, in Yerushalayim, there was something. There was, but not nearly as many scholars as there were in Tzfat. So he said, we're going to renew the smicha. And he organized a group, and he organized 25 of the greatest scholars in Tzfat, and they declared that Rabbi Yaakov Beirav is samuch. And they had an entire declaration. Smicha used to be done with an entire party. The Gemara says they used to sing songs and used to give a drasha and wear special clothing. They did a smicha ritual in the city of Tzfat in 1538 using the population of scholars that they had there. Among the group was Rabbi Yosef Cairo himself, the ultimate author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Mabit, Moshe Trani, and a number of other great scholars, and they renewed the smicha. Now, why was he doing this? Ostensibly, he was doing this for what purpose? In order to be able to have a court of three people have smicha to give lashes to Maranos and Anusim, who wanted to lose the stigma of Kares, right? But whether he also had messianic plans of his own, because now if you see the Rambam's clearly connecting that this concept, the renewal of smicha, to allow the coming of Mashiach. Whether the Yaakov Beirav had that in his mind also, it's not clear. But in his dialogue with, we'll see it in his arguments and his debate, he mentioned that the people who are countering him are holding back the coming of Mashiach. So he obviously had this in his mind. I don't know if he knew about Shlomo Molcho's prophecy that Mashiach was going to come in the year 1540, which is only 2 years later than the 1538 that he was trying to establish the smicha. But it's very possible there was an air of Kabbalistic leaning that was going on. The Yosef Cairo was well entrenched in Kabbalistic learning and practices, and there could have been this idea of a desire to get Mashiach to come, to be able to ultimately create the Sanhedrin, not just to have smicha to allow this to do a smicha to be able to do a court of three to give Malkus lashes, but actually to go the next step and recreate the Sanhedrin and go forward, make a melech, everything that's involved, and that the things, all the possibilities to having a real Sanhedrin open up. So, however, he knew that there were scholars in Yerushalayim that he hadn't included in the process, which was a big mistake. He didn't include them. But he realized that there were great people there. One of the greatest of them was this Rabbi Levi Ibn Chaviv, Levi Ibn Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, known as the Maubach for his an acronym. And Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, however, didn't ignore him. He sent an agent named by the name of Shlomo Chazan with a written writ in which he was ordaining and giving this new smicha that he had just gotten. The first person he gave it to was to the rabbi of Yerushalayim, the Ralbach, Reb Levi Ibn Chaviv. You don't have to be, you could convey, the Rambam says you can convey the smicha by writing, you don't have to be in the same presence, as long as they're both in Eretz Yisrael, and they were both in Eretz Yisrael. So he sent with this Reb Shlomo Chazan a statement to the leaders of the rabbis in Jerusalem, telling them the news that we have reestablished the smicha in Tzfat, and we are also conveying one of those ordinations, a smicha, to the rabbi of Yerushalayim, Reb Levi Ibn Chaviv. So they thought he'd be very happy when he got it, but he wasn't. He said, no, I can't accept this smicha. because I feel that it's not authoritative and does not have grounds and it's not viable based on halacha. He had a number of points that he disagreed with. The first thing is, what's the first thing when you read the Rambam? When you read the Rambam, what's the first thing that you might notice that would disqualify this smicha?
The fact that it required all the wise men.
Right. It said all the wise men in Eretz Yisrael. So this wasn't all the wise men because you left us out. He says a language there. He says, even though there are more of you in Tzfas than us, but the lav katle kanya anan, which means in Aramaic, sounds like, you know, we're not just bushwhackers here. You know, we have some status too, you know. So he didn't include everyone. And then he went further. He said, maybe you'll tell me that in halacha, rov, majority, is always considered like kol. A majority in halacha is always the status of the entirety. In halacha, rubo kikulo. So when you have a court that convenes, do they have to be unanimous in order to come out with a decision? No. Majority decision rules. So maybe you'll say that because there are more of you, and you might constitute a majority of the scholars in Israel, that you qualify as being kol, because using this concept of rov, majority is like all. So he said, so Malnach said, Levi Ibn Chava said, you might be right. And that would be true if we had all gotten together and had a discussion and we debated this issue, and then as a corpus, as a body, we said the majority decided that we should go ahead with the smicha, and the minority had been overruled after discourse and discussion, then you could say that the majority is considered like all. But if you never had any discussion with us, then you can't say rove is like all. If there was never contact and communication and dialogue and discourse, then you don't have a status of all just because you happen to be more. It's majority, not more. And majority implies that there's an entity in which you are a majority of. We're not an entity unless we convene, get together, and have a face-to-face conversation. So, maybe you'll tell me, okay, we'll start over again. Because he knew he had the majority in Tzfas, so, all right, so we'll get together at some point between Tzfas and Yerushalayim, and we'll have a meeting face-to-face, and we'll still win, because we're the majority. So there, Levi Ibn Chavis says, no, you've already disqualified yourself. Because since you extended yourself to such an extent, whatever impartiality you have to be able to adjudicate on this has been lost, and therefore the opportunity is gone. There's no way to fix up what you've done. Okay? And then he said another thing. He said, also, this whole idea that you have, that it pays to reestablish the smicha in order to what? To give lashes, the only lashes that take away the stigma of kares are lashes that are given by a court through the system of the court with witnesses and warning. A person can't just volunteer for lashes and it can be considered an act of the court to somehow take away the stigma of kares. It's only a court created punishment of lashes. And that's only going to happen if you actually have witnesses and hasra. You don't give punishments of lashes unless there's witnesses and warning. These people, these Muranos who you want to give lashes to, never were warned. They never had any witnesses. They're coming on along by themselves and saying, give us lashes so that we should be, lose the stigma of kares. It's not going to work. There's no such concept. It doesn't work. That's not an act. Courts don't act that way. It has to be a court-delivered punishment of lashes in order to take away the stigma of kares. And the last thing he said, two more things he said, was that how could you rule to do this based on the Rambam if the Rambam himself started out, the nearly it appears to me, and his last words were, Hadavar Tzarich Hechreya, that the issue still needs resolution. That's saying that this issue is not resolved. You can't act on a decision that was a non-decision, a decision that was made because and predicated with the same sentence that we still need to decide how what the ruling is. And the last thing he said was, you know what you're going to do now, Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav? If you want to reinstitute smicha, you're going to have to revert back to the calendar calculations that are based on quartz that are hearing from witnesses who see the new moon. He felt, the Ralnach felt, that we can utilize we can channel the Kiddush HaChodesh of Hillel from the 3rd century is only because there isn't an option of a court system that can actually declare the new month on their own. But if you're going to reestablish the Smicha, and you'll have a court, either 3 according to the Rambam or 23 according to the Rambam, of people who have smicha, who can establish a new month based on the court created new month based on testimony from witnesses, you'll be obligated to put that system back into effect. And what will happen then? You put that system into effect, so we're going to say in Sfas they're going to start telling people that they'll establish the calendar, and how are the people in Italy going to find out? And how are the people in Cairo going to find out? And how are the people in Fez, Morocco going to find out? So you're going to create smicha, you're going to create this entity that will have halachic implications that go beyond what you want to do. And that's what he wrote in his treatise back to the people of back to the Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav in Sfas, saying, I object for these reasons. First of all, you don't have the kol. You don't have all of the rabbis in Israel. Second of all, you only have majority. Second of all, there's no point in it because you're not going to be able to give lashes anyway that will impact the stigma of Kares. The Rambam himself said that it's not conclusive. He's clearly saying, don't make a decision based on what I said. It's ein lo achreya. It's not conclusive. And also, I'm scared that if you're going to get into a whole mess of halachic implications if you establish the smicha, the worst problem will be is that you're going to have to revert back to the calendar when you're able to scrap Hillel's calendar that the entire world is using and go back to the calendar that's established month by month by the adjudicating court. So Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav got he heard when Shlomo Chazan came back, he heard what he had to say, and he wrote a response. And he said an interesting thing. He said, you know, the words in the Rambam, when he says the issue, however, requires resolution, isn't referring to the entire issue. It's only referring to one little detail that he had said. The Rambam had said that what happens is when you want to reestablish a court, if you have one person with smicha, he can reestablish the court smicha by giving smicha, even though we said smichas with 3 dayanim, only one of them has to have smicha in order to convey smicha. And that was the issue that he's referring to when he says the issue requires resolution. Now, honestly, when I saw that, I read that in his response, Yaakov Bei Rav, I was really shocked because any reading of the Rambam really doesn't fit with that. And I couldn't believe he said that. And that's really what got me thinking that there must have been a lot driving this more than just the ability to give Malkus to people who want to lose the stigma of Kares. With regards to the other question of it says all and you're only your majority, listen, in halacha, rov is like kol. Majority is always qualified as all, and the issue that you're making that it's not a majority, it's only a more, he didn't think was really a real issue. And with regards to the Kiddush HaChodesh, he said, Kiddush HaChodesh is done, making the new month is done by Sanhedrin. I have no interest, claimed Rabbi Yaakov Bei Rav, in taking that next step of establishing a Sanhedrin. I am not interested in going that far. I am only interested in establishing courts of 3 people who have smicha in order to be able to give the punishment of Malkus. There's no way that we're planning to make a Sanhedrin, and there's nothing to... They debated back and forth over a year, and finally they appealed to a neutral party, and that was Rav David Ben Zimra, the Radvaz. in Egypt. He was the rabbi in Egypt, and he has a commentary on the Rambam, and he responded and he sided with Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv. And that really was a big damper. That really stopped the initiative to a large extent. However, before that happened, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, in Tzfas, he was a wealthy man. He had a lot of holdings in Damascus. The government started hearing about the fact that here's this guy who's starting to, the Turks were in charge then of Tzfas. He said, here's this person who's starting to create a new government, independent government, and they weren't so happy about it. So he felt it prudent to leave Tzfas and go to Damascus, where he had a home. He lives in Damascus also, where he had come from. But he knew that if he went to Damascus, would he be able to give smicha to anyone else? No, because Damascus is clearly out of Eretz Yisrael. So before he left, he said, I better do smicha to a group of people in order to keep the smicha alive. And he gave smicha to four people. Two of them we know. The other two, it's not sure. One of those four people was none other than Rabbi Yosef Cairo. Rabbi Yosef Cairo had signed on the smicha of the Yaakov Beirav. And he was the head of the court in Tzfas. And he actually made a writ of court, which he sent to the Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv, saying that he felt that the smicha was legitimate. So, Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, before he fled to Damascus, quickly gave smicha to four people. One of them was Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, and the other one was Rabbi Moshe Mitrani the Mabit. And he writes in his letters, he compares himself to, you see the scene? He's giving smicha with his life being endangered, and he's endangering his life staying longer in Tzfas before he runs to Damascus. And who does he think he's acting like? Rabbi Yehuda Mebava. And he writes it. He said, I did like Rabbi Yehuda Mebava, and I sacrificed my life in order to maintain the smicha, to give smicha to Rabbi Yosef Cairo, and to the Mabit, and to two others. And then he went to Damascus, and ultimately he died 5 years later, and he's buried in Tzfas. His body was brought back, and he's buried in Tzfas. But his ideas didn't really take hold. And the Beis Yosef had the smicha. And that's a really beautiful irony if you think about it, right? Because the Beis Yosef is the poseg for the Jews from that time on. The Shulchan Aruch was accepted as definitive and authoritative halacha. And it was written, he started writing the Torah, which is what Shulchan Aruch is based on, after he got that, he finished the work after he got that smicha. So if you think about it, that's a certain inch that he didn't accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, but he did make it that the person who he gave smicha to ended up being the person who was a judge, so to speak, for all of the Jewish people. However, in his writings, the Beis Yosef himself, he mentions the Rambam at one point. He mentions the Rambam's concept. But everywhere else, whenever the issue of ruling Dine Knossos comes up, which is the things that you need to be a samuch, you need to have ordination for, he implies that ordination doesn't exist. But he did give his smicha over to students of his by the name of Rav Moshe Alshich, who wrote a famous commentary on Chumash. Rav Moshe Alshich lived in Tzfas in the next 20 years when the Arizal was there and the Ramak, Rav Moshe Cordovero. And Rav Moshe Alshich gave smicha to a person named Reb Chaim Vital. Reb Chaim Vital was the primary student of the Arizal. Arizal, who was the innovator of Kabbalah, brought Kabbalah to a Kabbalistic study to a new level, went to Tzfas because he had heard, in order specifically to teach his teachings of Kabbalah to Reb Chaim Vital. And this Reb Chaim Vital received this extra smicha from Reb Moshe Alshich. And that's the end of the chain of smicha as we know it. just interesting, I just saw an interesting thing, it made me think. Reb Chaim Vital, one of the things that he was, that the Arizal instituted was practical Kabbalah. And he was able to tell people who was a Shoresh HaNeshama, where their souls came from. What they were Gilgulim of, transmigration of souls, whose soul came from whom. So the Chaim Vital writes that the Beis Yosef, Reb Yosef Cairo, that his soul is a extension of the soul of Reb Yehuda Bar Eloi. Reb Yehuda Bar Eloi. Reb Yehuda Bar Eloi was one of the five people who had smicha from Reb Yehuda Ben Bava. So here you have Reb Yosef Cairo getting smicha from Reb Yaakov Beirav, who saw himself, he described himself as a continuation of the tradition of Yehuda ben Bava, and then you have Reb Chaim Vital saying, yes, Reb Yosef Cairo was really a Gilgal of Reb Yehuda ben Eloi. Anyway, that's the end of that story. It's a, whether there's more to it, it fizzled out. Nothing really came from it. But I have to tell you a couple things. How do we deal with the issue, though? The Rambam brings up an issue that how is Mashiach going to come if the Sanhedrin has to come first? Who's going to make the Sanhedrin if you can't jumpstart the smicha? That was what the Rambam's problem was. And the Radvaz says, and this is a tradition we have, that Elio will come. And Elio is alive, and he received smicha from Achia Ashiloni, and he'll be able to redo it. Or he says that, another thing he says is that maybe there are Jews out there who we don't know, who have the unbroken chain. Maybe someone from the 10 tribes. In the 1800s, a student of the Gra, of the Vilna Gaon, named Yisrael Mishklov, went on a search for this, also wanted to reestablish the Sanhedrin in order to get Mashiach to come, and he actually went for a search for these Bnei Ruvain in order to be able to find someone who has smicha to be able to get things started. It gets even more interesting. Reb Yehuda Leib Maimon, who was a scholar and a Jewish leader when the Jewish state got started in 1948, he said, what's it going to be? The Jewish people are going to use Turkish law, they're going to use British law, they're going to use Swiss law. They should use Jewish law. But to take halacha as it is and apply it to a modern society is not going to work. We need a Sanhedrin. He said, we need a Sanhedrin. And he got a group of people, of rabbis together in Tveria, and tried to talk to them about starting the Sanhedrin, and he was unsuccessful. And believe it or not, in this, 10 years ago, there's a group of people who want also to restart Sanhedrin. They want to be able to establish a bunch of things that they feel only Sanhedrin can establish in their efforts to start have Kabbonos, and they also tried to use the Rambam. But now they had emails, they were able to send emails to all different shuls and that they got, and they said, and the majority of the responses they counted to ordain a rabbi, and I don't know how much validity it has, but I'm saying the ideas, the desire to see this smicha as a vehicle to allow a situation where Mashiach comes, being proactive to be able to bring Mashiach in this way versus the halachic strictures that say, no, we have to follow halacha with the rules and as with the system that we have, and you can't say, oh, the Rambam was referring to a different thing. You have to follow the laws and the system of halacha with the logic that and the things that are dictated by that logic. This is the controversial debate that's been really lies behind this interesting story. Okay, any questions?
Do you think that the people of Smicha today have anything to do with what was?
Not really. No, it's not that Smicha. It's just a term.
Is it the same all over within Orthodoxy?
Yeah. It's certain parallels in that they're also a Smicha. That person, in order to get Smicha, you need to be expert in all of Torah. But they had smicha in certain areas. So that's also now, they have these smicha, people get smicha yora yora to be able to decide ritual law, yadin yadin to decide monetary law. But it's more it's not that smicha. It's not the smicha that empowers them to be a court. It's really just a way of quality control, establishing status and you know, for people's sake.
Okay. Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.